Bibles with you, you can go ahead and open up to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. We will be finishing up chapter 7 today. 2 weeks ago, I said that I would go back to a passage from a sermon from the sermon that we had 2 weeks ago to tie up some loose ends and then to jump into this week's sermon. So we're going to start in verse 7, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 7. I wish that all of you were as I am, but each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. One of the things we talked about a few weeks ago was that Paul does something very unique here. He actually exalts and honors the gift of singleness. That was virtually unheard of at the time. The Jews said that there were seven kinds of men God would not accept. The first, number one, was a man who had never been married. Number one, the very first, the number one man that God could not accept was the man who had never been married. Number two was the man who had never had biological children, never had his own children. And we saw that the Greeks and the Romans also did not view singleness with honor, that they viewed singles with suspicion. So against that background, Paul honored singleness as a gift that could be as honoring to God as marriage. Paul saw that singleness could be good, could honor God as much as marriage, and that it could be a blessing. At that same time, we also talked about something else that Paul did, which was he honored marriage in a way that was unique. Paul said that there was a mutuality and a reciprocity in marriage between a husband and wife that was unheard of in the ancient Near East. This is what he said earlier in the chapter. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. The church fathers Theodoret and Chrysostom expound how this was unique, that for the very first time in history, in fact, Theodoret specifically says, for the first time in history, Paul expounds that this teaching would apply both to men and women, that there would be this mutuality and reciprocity in marriage that was unheard of in the ancient Near East. But the church father Origen also told us that Paul took it a step further because he said not only do the husband and wife have mutuality and reciprocity in marriage, but that sometimes the husband would fulfill his wife's sexual desires even if he got nothing out of it. And that he said that there was a responsibility the husband had to the wife that was also unheard of. That the church fathers understood that the gospel as it came into people's lives would transform their marriages. And we saw that marriage would have a holy and redemptive cause. And we talked about that 2 weeks ago. And it's against that backdrop that we need to go back to this verse in verse 8 and 9. Now to the unmarried and the widows I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. This passage gets a lot of attention. And my fear, church, is that sometimes it is misunderstood, misapplied, and misused. It's taken outside of the context of what Paul says about marriage and the way husbands and wives ought to interact with each other. And in that way, it's used in a way that Paul never intended. You see, the way some people interpret this passage or use it, they say if a man is oversexed, a man or woman is oversexed, too horny, can't control themselves, they should get married and that'll solve all their problems. Let me say that again. Thank you. Thank you, Tom, by the way. The way some people interpret and use the book, they say if your way to solve that problem is get married and all your problems will go away. Really? Is that what Paul is saying? Is Paul is saying that you take your over-sex drive, your high libido, your sexual brokenness, your addiction to pornography and sex, get married and everything goes away? Does Paul really seem to imply that when we get married, our spouses become our sexual slaves to fulfill our overactive, uncontrolled passions and lusts? Paul does not seem to imply that marriage solves our problem with sexuality. What Paul poses as an alternative, however, is a holy sexuality, a sexuality that is cultivated in the context of a marriage that is holy and redemptive, where a husband and wife belong to each other, where a husband and wife lay down their desires for each other, where a husband and wife will daily reenact the gospel call. Paul says that if someone, man or woman, is uncontrolled in their sex drive, has too much libido, has sexual brokenness or perversion, addiction to pornography, sexual addiction, or other problems, that the answer is not just having sex in marriage, but rather that you enter the covenant of marriage that is holy and redemptive, and you pursue a holy sexuality where the husband's body belongs to his wife, where the wife's body belongs to her husband, when they each lay down their desires to help take care of the needs of the other, and they daily reenact the gospel call. And in that context, you answer sexual brokenness with a holy sexuality. You see, if sex in marriage was supposed to be the cure to sexual brokenness, then it's a very poor cure. You see, Lisa and I are married. And before we got married, we made an agreement not to sexually self-satisfy. That's a euphemism for a more loud term that I will avoid for the sake of some of you. But we made an agreement not to sexually self-satisfy. But as you can imagine, that still doesn't give me a right to demand sex anytime I want. There have been times where I've wanted to have sex and we didn't have sex. There were times Lisa wanted to have sex and we didn't have sex. And if sex in marriage was supposed to be the cure, it didn't work very well. Some of you know that as a child, I had an uncle who was inappropriate with me. And as a result of that childhood trauma, to this day, I have a really hard time with being tickled or poked. And because I had an uncle who was very inappropriate with me, that physical touch was very challenging. One time, John Calmes poked me, and then he saw that I had this reaction, and John, being the kind of guy that he is, if something bothers you, he likes to poke at it a few more times. And this was before I was married, before he was married, and he was just poking at me, just being a guy and taking advantage of my, like, rah. And I almost punched him because it was hitting on a nerve that predates our friendship or anything else that happened in my life. And you could imagine as that brokenness came into our marriage, I brought it into our marriage, you could imagine the challenge of me being Lisa's sexual partner and her being mine, the challenges we would face. To this day, I feel very uneasy with playful wrestling because it brings up bad memories of being thrown to the ground. And you can imagine that if having sex in marriage was supposed to be the cure to sexual brokenness, imagine the challenge of pursuing sexual healing in the context of having sexual brokenness that predates the marriage. If sex in marriage was supposed to be the cure, it's a terrible cure. You see, I brought in pain that had nothing to do with Lisa. I brought in brokenness that had nothing to do with Lisa. I had anger that had nothing to do with Lisa. I had sadness and fear that had nothing to do with Lisa. But Lisa took responsibility for the healing. She owned the journey to wholeness. She refused to give up hope. She held on to patience, and she acted graciously. And in that way, she lived out a holy sexuality in our marriage that was holy and redemptive. And to this day, we continue to work that out. Lisa is daily reenacting the gospel call with me to live out a holy sexuality, to redeem my brokenness into a fullness of God's call for what the gospel means for our marriage. But I have to say, church, when people say, if you're just burning with lust, get married, they are fooling you. And it's naive and unrealistic and unfair to what Paul says to think that Paul thinks that your sexual brokenness will simply be cured by your marriage. There are men and women in this church who weekly go to recovery groups because despite their marriage, they still struggle with sexual brokenness. And I want you to know that if you're in this church and you struggle with sexual brokenness, you are amongst friends and family who love you, who will walk with you and who understand the gospel call to redeem all aspects of our brokenness. But I want to make clear what Paul says here is not simply get married, have sex, and be done. What Paul says is take your sexual brokenness and enter into a holy sexuality and a holy redemptive marriage with a partner whose body will belong to you and yours to them, who will lay down their desires for your needs and you for them, and who will daily reenact the gospel call with you so that your marriage daily proclaims the gospel of Jesus Christ. And with that, let's jump into this week's text. Now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give you a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you pledged to a woman? Do not seek to be released. Are you free from such a commitment? Do not look for a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. What I mean, brothers and sisters, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they do not. Those who mourn, as if they did not. Those who are happy, as if they were not. Those who buy something, as if it were not theirs to keep. Those who use the things of this world, as if not engrossed in them. For this world in its present form is passing away. I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife, and his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I'm saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. If anyone thinks he is not treating his daughter properly, and if she's getting old in years, and he feels she ought to marry, he should do as he wants. He is not sinning. He should let her get married. But the man who has settled the matter in his own mind, who is under no compulsion but has control over his own will, and who has made up his mind to keep the virgin unmarried, this man also does the right thing. So then, he who gives his virgin in marriage does right, but he who does not give her in marriage does better. A woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes. But he must belong to the Lord. In my judgment, she is happier if she stays as she is. And I think that I too have the Spirit of God. The grass withers, the flowers fade, but the word of the Lord stands forever. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Verse 25. Now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I want you to note that Paul starts out by saying he is giving you a well thought out opinion. He specifically says, I don't have a command of the Lord, but I'm giving you my opinion. Scholars debate what exactly he means by this. Some say that Paul is specifically letting you know he's not quoting from Jesus. Others say that he's trying to introduce a new teaching into the church. The problem is elsewhere where Paul wants to introduce a teaching that he wants to apply everywhere, he says, this is my rule for all the churches, or he'll say churches everywhere, or he'll say, I want this to apply to all Christians everywhere. Paul does not say that here. Paul says that he's answering a question they asked him. Remember, we talked about that 2 weeks ago. They wrote a letter to Paul asking him questions. They asked him a question, and so he's answering them, but he says to them up front, I have to tell you, God has not specifically spoken in this area. Jesus did not specifically talk about this, so I'm going to give you my well-informed, thought-out opinion. It's well thought out, and it's well considered because Paul knows them. Paul spent over a year and a half ministering in Corinth. Paul worked with the tradesmen. He lived with people in the city. He walked by and saw the temple of Aphrodite. He walked by the port side. He saw the fishermen. He built tents for people. He repaired tents for people. He worked with people there, and he knew all the leaders in the church. So when they came and they gave him a letter by the church, he's going to give them an opinion because he knows what they're facing and he knows the people he's writing to. And he's going to give them a thought out opinion based on his understanding of the gospel, their culture, and how they ought to best live their lives in light of all of that. The problem is they asked a question about virgins, and we have no idea what they asked. We don't know, did they ask about fathers who were worried about their virgin daughters, and should they be given in marriage? We don't know if they asked Paul about people who were engaged to be married, but were thinking about not getting married. We don't know if they asked about people who were virgins and wanted to get married. We don't know if it's about people who were engaged and still planning their wedding, or we don't know if it's people who had been engaged and had been broken up with. We just have no idea what they asked him about the virgins. So all we know is they asked something about virgins, and he's going to answer something about virgins. And so the challenge of that is, as we think about how we might apply it, we have to remember we are listening in to half the conversation. And so we have to proceed carefully because Paul doesn't tell us what their question was, and we don't understand, we don't know what they asked him, and the assumptions we make sometimes in that regard will get us into trouble for how we apply the text. So instead, you just have to remember that Paul is starting off with his opinion because he's answering a question that they specifically asked that we don't know what it was. Going on, Paul says this, because of the present crisis, I think that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Not only does Paul say he's giving you his opinion, not only is he responding to a question that we don't know what it was, but he specifically says because of this present crisis. He tells them up front, everything he's going to say afterwards is in light of this present crisis. The New American Standard and the ESV call it distress. New Testament scholars N.T. Wright and Bruce Winters think that this is referring to a famine that was hitting the Greek countryside that started in about A.D. 50, right around the time Paul would be ministering in Corinth. It lasted for almost 10 years, 5 to 10 years that this famine was hitting the Greek countryside, and it was specifically hitting those who were poor and disenfranchised the most. Because if you're poor and the famine hits, guess who already has food in the storage area? It's the rich people. Guess who doesn't have food? It's the poor people. The famine hits, you have no food in storage, you starve. And in fact, the reason is because the Greek word translated crisis or distress was often used to refer to starvation. And so N.T. Wright and Bruce Winter believe that Paul is referring to a crisis of famine that is hitting the church because it's hitting the entire country of Greece. Others believe that it's actually referring to persecution, that the Christians are going through persecution, and that because of what's happening, that the Christians are facing starvation and persecution, and because times are so tough, that what you do in light of that is going to be different. What I want you to see, church, is what Paul says is he's giving you his opinion in light of what's happening in Greece, in Corinth at the time. And that might not be the same thing he would say to a church in a different place, at a different time, facing different circumstances. Does that make sense? He's talking about a church that is facing some crisis or distress, and he wants them to understand that in light of that distress, he thinks that they should remain as they are. Some scholars believe that this is like what they told the Jews, how the Jews felt going into World War II. Pre-World War II, the Jews in Nazi Germany were struggling. Germany was facing food rationing, a terrible economy, and overblown inflation, and the Jews were suffering because the whole country of Germany was suffering. As a result, the Jews in Germany were facing specific distress and crisis. And because of that, the things that they were practicing pre-World War II were not necessarily the way they would practice all the time because they were facing a crisis. And it's in that mode that Paul continues. I think that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you pledged to a woman? Do not seek to be released. Are you free from such a commitment? Do not look for a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. You get this, but those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. You get the sense that Paul is looking at this distress, this crisis that they're facing, this persecution that the church is facing, and he's asked, being asked about virgins. I don't know what he's asked about virgins. He's asked something about them. But in that phase, what he says is, I want you to stay the course. Weather the storm and be a light. You get the sense that Paul is looking at a church that is suffering. And in the midst of suffering, rather than focusing on major change, he says to stay the course, weather the storm, and be a light. In fact, Trevor talked about that last week. Instead of focusing so much on changing your circumstances, maybe you should first be a light in the circumstances where God has called you. That rather than worry about changing your circumstances, for which you often have no control, maybe you should focus on your calling from God and be a light in the circumstance to which you were called. But Paul also says, but know that marriage can make it harder. Know that marriage can make it harder. See, this is the funny thing. If you're single too long, you think everybody who's married has it going great. And then when you've been married for a while, you think, oh, I wish I was single again. And you have this thing that you kind of always are jealous of what other people have. But what Paul is saying is, in the current circumstance, in this current distress, know that you can get married, but know that it might make life harder. And in fact, what historians will tell you, that in the face of Nazi oppression and concentration camps, the Jews who were married with kids reported having a harder time. Because rather than just focusing on survival, they had to worry about their children and their spouses. And some of those who suffered the most were those who were separated from their spouses and their kids because they never knew what was going to happen to them. That the present crisis paired with the marriage made life difficult for them. So in light of that, Paul says, stay steady, weather the storm, be a light, but know that marriage could make things harder. Going on, Paul says this, what I mean, brothers and sisters, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they do not. Those who mourn, as if they did not. Those who are happy, as if they were not. Those who buy something, as if it were not theirs to keep. Those who use the things of this world, as if not engrossed in them. For this world, in its present form, is passing away. You see, the Apostle Paul wants them to see that what they are facing is temporary. But not just that, that time is temporary. That the things we have, the relationships we have on earth, our beloved dogs like Charlie. Some of you know. Some of you are dying for me to mention Charlie in a sermon, so there it is. They are temporary. They are not eternal. And so God wants us to focus on the things in our lives with an eternal perspective. Don't act like your husband and wife is all you have for all eternity. Don't act like your job and your health and your ability to run triathlons and climb mountains and go barreling down mountains or go deep sea diving. Don't act like those things are going to be with you forever. Look at your loved ones knowing that you have them now, but that none of us will be forever. And live in such a way that you understand the value and the temporalities of life. This is what Eugene Peterson says. I do want to point out, friends, that time is of the essence. There is no time to waste, so don't complicate your lives unnecessarily. Keep it simple. In marriage, grief, joy, whatever, even in ordinary things, your daily routines of shopping and so on, deal as sparingly as possible with the things the world thrusts on you. This world, as you see it, is on its way out. The idea that Paul is saying is that we get so involved in things. We put all our hopes in things. And as a consequence, we get divided and we lose track of who we are. We lose track of where our lives are. And we lose all bearing in reality. Because we get lost, you know, sometimes we get lost in our spouses. We get lost in the things we have. And instead, he says, we have to regard them in the right perspective. This is what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus. You get this sense as he's talking about that distress, even as he's writing a second letter to them, that distress is continuing. Whatever's happening is continuing, and it ain't very good. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake so that this life may be revealed in our mortal body. So then death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. Therefore, we do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. Therefore, we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Paul reminds them in 1 Corinthians, he reminds them again in 1 Corinthians 4, to look at things with that eternal perspective, to know that you don't have infinite time. Maybe some of you have put so much in your spouse, and their hopes and your dreams are in your spouse, and then you don't even have the time to say, I'm sorry, and to make up for something because you've been holding it in. Or maybe you've hurt them in ways you don't even realize, and you don't have in you to apologize, but you may never have tomorrow. What Paul tells us is to regard things in an eternal perspective, to regard your spouse not as yours, but as God's gift to you for now, that you will one day return to him as a gift back to him. And in the same way, your children, your job, your health, and your things, they all belong to God, who has given them to you for but a moment, and you will one day get to give them back to him in return. Going on, Paul says, I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife, and his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I'm saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. You get this sense that as Paul is writing to them facing this crisis, facing this trouble, trying to answer a question that they have, his goal is to help them to live an undivided, devoted life to God. I may not know what question they asked Paul exactly. I may not know what crisis they were facing. But I can ask myself the question, am I living an undivided, devoted life to God? Paul's desire is that each of us would live an undivided, devoted life. Maybe for you this morning, you are divided because you are pining away to be married. Maybe you are divided because you have put your spouse in the place of God in your life. Maybe you are divided because you are concerned not about your wife or husband or about getting married, but you're worried about your job. What is it in your life that is pulling on you for devotion? When you look at your calendar and your pocketbook and your worries and your prayers, what do they say about what you are devoted to? When you look at your life, in the places where no one else can see, what is your heart's devotion? You see, Paul says, make your life simple. Make it simple by being devoted only to God. That there's a way to be devoted to your spouse in a way that honors God. And there's a way to be devoted to your spouse that replaces God. There's a way to be focused on your singleness that honors God. And there's a way to focus on your singleness that replaces God. There's a way to work that honors God. And there's a way to work that replaces God. There's a way to exercise and to dress up that honors God. But there's a way to exercise and dress up that replaces God. There's a way to work hard and gain prestige and success that honors God. And there's a way that works hard to succeed and gain prestige and replaces God. And each and every one of us, regardless of our state, single or married, can ask the question of what our heart's devotion is. And this morning, church, if you hear nothing else, maybe you can ask yourself the question, where is my heart's devotion? Going on, Paul says this: if anyone thinks he is not treating his daughter properly, and if she's getting along in years and he feels she ought to marry, he should do as he wants. He is not sinning. He should let her get married. But the man who has settled the matter in his own mind, who is under no compulsion but has control over his own will, and who has made up his mind to keep the virgin unmarried, this man also does the right thing. So then, he who gives his virgin in marriage does right, but he who does not give her in marriage does better. Now, some of you who are reading along know that I'm reading out of the NIV, but I substituted the reading from the margin rather than the reading that's in the main text. And that's because that reading matches the reading that is in the New American Standard Version and was the historical reading of the church. It's the reading that the church father Chrysostom used. It's the reading that Calvin used. It's the reading that Luther used. And up until about 100 years ago, it was the predominant reading of the text in the church. It's changed a bit over the last 100 years, not because of any new discoveries, not because the text is uncertain, but because legitimately the Greek words have some ambiguity. And before I go into the weeds to help explain that, I want to tell you about one of my favorite scenes from the movie Finding Nemo. There's a scene in Finding Nemo where Nemo's father has gathered some friends, and they want to find Nemo, but they find themselves in an aquarium stuck. So Nemo's father says, "Think dirty thoughts." He wants them to think about poop, because the dirtier they make the aquarium, the sooner the aquarium get taken out of the aquarium, and as they're cleaning the aquarium, the fish have their opportunity to escape. Now, if I walked into a room and said, "Think dirty thoughts," some of you would not think about poop. Some of you who are overworked with children might be thinking about dirty diapers and a messy house, but some of you might be thinking about other things. And in fact, depending on the way I looked at you and said it, that might lead you in a particular way when I say, "Think dirty thoughts." In addition, there's a song. It says, "If I told you your body was beautiful, would you hold it against me?" Well, you can imagine, depending on how I say it, how I gesture when I look at you, the response I'm trying to get out of you would be different. And how you respond to me would be different. It's entirely determined by context. So the problem with this passage is we don't know the full context of what's being said because we don't know the question that they asked about virgins in verse 25. And even as they go on now, we're uncertain. So the words have double meaning. So for example, in verse 36, it says, "If anyone thinks he's not treating his daughter properly." You see, the Greek word there for the margin says daughters is actually just the word virgin. And just virgin. If anyone thinks he is not treating his virgin properly. The Greek says his virgin properly. The problem is we don't know who his is and we don't know who virgin is. So the NIV and the ESV say betrothed or fiance, but the New American Standard says daughter. And some translations say virgin you are engaged to, even though engaged to is like in italics because they added to understand. All of these are legitimate meanings. It could mean a daughter. It could just mean someone who's unmarried, or it could mean someone who's engaged. All three are valid interpretations and applications of the word. Next, Paul says, "And if she is getting along in years." The Greek word is huperakmos. It just means, it means like very mature, climaxed, beyond their peak. Many times it's used to refer to somebody who has reached their prime age, maturity. And so this is why the CSB, the New King James, the NAT, and the New ASB all use this getting along in years, or sometimes they'll say beyond the flower of youth. But it could also mean somebody who's overwhelmed, climaxed emotionally, overwhelmed. And it's rarely used that way, but that's also possible. And that's why the NIV, the ESV, and the NLT use the term burning or overloaded with passion. Ironically, that's not the same word Paul uses in verse 9 when he talks about burning with passion. So again, you have two options here. Well, then next he says, he should let her get married. And so you'll notice here that the New American Standard and some translations say he should let her get married. And that's because the Greek word is gametso, which means to give in marriage. And so the other translations will say he should marry her. So, you guys are all looking at me. I got the glazed looks. Let me bring this back down. So if you look at these possible combinations, there are more than six possible ways to look at the text. Paul could be talking about a father who has a virgin daughter who's getting old and whether or not he should marry her off. Paul could be talking about a father with a virgin daughter who has a high sex drive and he's not sure she can stay a virgin. Paul could be talking about a father who has a virgin, but who's getting so old himself, he may not be able to take care of her anymore. Paul could be talking about a person who's engaged to a girl who's getting old, and he hasn't married her yet. Paul could be talking about somebody who's engaged, and his fiance has a high sex drive. Paul could also be talking about somebody who has a fiance, and he has a high sex drive and doesn't know what to do. And in any case, all of these can apply. There's a lot of uncertainty, and this is why the text has had various translations throughout history. In countries where familial ties and community and family responsibility are high, almost uniformly they favor the context of a father asking questions about how do I take care of my virgin daughter in face of a crisis with persecution, starvation, and everything. In countries that are more in the West and in the last 100 years, they focused more on burning with passion and relieving your sexual desires. And the answer is the text doesn't make it clear which one he's talking about. I personally find this to be genius. It's amazing to me that the Holy Spirit could use these words that have some ambiguity and give one word that would apply to more than six different situations. It's amazing to me that these words could be used to apply to so many different aspects of our lives. So with that, in the face of this uncertainty, let's look at what we can find that is certain. The first is this: whether single or married, we ought to be intentional. Notice this is what Paul says. The man who has settled the matter in his own mind, who is under no compulsion but has control over his own will, and who has made up his mind to keep the virgin unmarried, this man also does the right thing. You notice that as Paul talks about it, he talks about somebody who has made up his own mind, who has decided in his heart, who has controlled his whole will to whatever he's doing. He gets the sense that he's calling this person to be intentional. You see, the problem with us in the church is not how we view singleness versus marriage. The problem is we often stumble into singleness or marriage accidentally. We're not very intentional about it. Have you ever thought, are you better as a husband or as a single man? Have you ever asked yourself, are you better as a single woman or as a wife? Have you ever asked yourself, what does it mean to take your single life and live in a consecrated, holy way that honors God? Have you asked, how can you live in marriage to honor God better than you did as a single? Have you asked yourself how being single might take you away from something that you are totally doing well as a single, and then getting married will take you away from that? You see, Paul says that whether single or married, you ought to be intentional. And too many times we stumble along and go whatever way the current carries us. But this person, the people that Paul is talking about, the people who he says are doing right, whether married or single, are the people who have intentionally chosen marriage or singleness. And so maybe you're here this morning and you're married. You don't get a free pass because this is addressed to virgins. Because maybe the call that Paul offers you is, how are you being intentional in your marriage? How are you living a consecrated life in your marriage? What have you resolved in your heart? What compulsions have you controlled to fulfill God's sanctity in your marriage? What purpose are you bringing to your marriage to bring fullness? Maybe you're single and want to be married. You also don't get the free pass because Paul's not just saying, okay, this doesn't apply to you because you're going to get married. Paul's also asking you, what are you doing with your singleness? What are you doing to prepare yourself to be the husband or wife that would be holy and sanctifying to a spouse? What are you doing with your singleness now to honor God and to bring redemption into the world? In which ways are you controlling your compulsions for what God has called you to? Maybe you are single and you feel like you have the gift of singleness. This is an odd term. I never really hear people talking about the gift of singleness out in the world. I feel like it's one of these Christian terms we use, which we often use. But the weird thing about saying that somebody has the gift of singleness, most of the time we talk about it and it's the gift that none of us want. Have you ever, I mean, come on, some of you know what I'm talking about. You hear people talk about the gift of singleness, but it's like that white elephant gift that you hope someone else takes, or it's that gift someone gives you and you want to re-gift it. A lot of times we talk about this gift of singleness, but we act like it's the gift nobody wants. Paul says singleness can be holy and sanctified when it is intentional and purposefully chosen in light of God's call for your life. And we have to realize that neither singleness nor marriage in and of themselves become a gift when they are unsanctified and unholy, in an unholy way taken. And so we learn as a church not only to live intentionally, but to neither pity the single nor idolize marriage. You see, sometimes in the church, we mistreat single people because we often try to marry them off. Lisa worked for a church before she met me, and at that church, they started an unofficial ministry called the Get Lisa Married Ministry, and she worked with children's ministry, so all these moms, every time they saw her, they wanted to introduce her to another guy, and in fact, the reason why we met was because my friend's wife met Lisa and was like, I have this guy you need to go out with. I worked for churches before, and I was single, and for a long time, people wanted to do the Get Tim Jang Married Ministry until they realized they all failed, and so they all lost hope. We sometimes mistreat singles because we treat their singleness like a disease that needs to be cured. And if anything, what Paul says is here, one of the best ways you can treat a single person is to honor their singleness. Encourage them to walk in the sanctity of their holiness and encourage them to purposefully and intentionally embrace their stage of life. And if it means getting married, then help them to walk in it in a sanctified way. And if it is remaining single, help them to embrace their singleness and see the beauty of their singleness and stop trying to get them married. And imagine if you supported and encouraged the gifting and the ministry and the growth of people who are single in your life. And at the same time, we don't idolize marriage. When people talk about how great it's going to be when they get married, sorry, Austin and Lexi, tell them it ain't always roses. And tell them that they still are going to bring their sin into the marriage, and they're still going to have to work through sin in their marriage, and that the holiness of sanctity of their sex is going to be challenging at times for different reasons. There will be things that you don't know are coming into your marriage that you will have to deal with, and remind them that marriage is not the goal, but marriage is a gift that God gives them to walk in holiness towards Him. And so we can honor marriage without idolizing it, and we can care for singles without pitying them. And as a church, what Paul calls us to is to value both singleness and marriage. And lastly, Paul says this: a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. In my judgment, she is happier if she stays as she is, and I think that I too have the Spirit of God. You'll notice, remember, Paul says this is based in light of the present distress. He says, in face of distress and hard times, do not divorce your spouse, but rather remember that marriage is for life. It is God's intent that just like his love for us would be never ending, that when we enter the covenant of marriage, that we would forever live out that call to lovingly and forever care for those we've bound our lives to. And in that way, we will every day have the opportunity to live out the gospel call. In my family, there are some days where Lisa lives the gospel and I'm all the sin. And there are other days where Lisa's all the sin and I live out the gospel. But hopefully together between the two of us plus Charlie, we daily live out the gospel call to love and care for those in our lives as God would love and care for us at our worst. And in the same way, Paul reminds each and every one of us that if you choose to get married, you're both stuck for life, but also bound for life and hopefully blessed for life. Let's pray.